want to start by congratulating the campaign and Marge, really, because I think what it shows is that when it comes to the environment and to climate change, no campaign is too small. Not simply because little campaigns are important, but also because they give confidence for us to fight and campaign and win over bigger and wider issues. And there is no issue bigger and more important than the question of climate change. I'm going to frame my 10 minutes or so talk tonight by talking about two reports that have come out this week. You may have heard of them, you may even have read of them. The first is a report by the World Meteorological Organization, which probably saw summaries and articles about it in the newspapers today, where they have basically announced that global temperatures have already risen by 1 degree. The 2015 has been so warm that now the average temperature of the world is 1 degree higher than it was on pre-industrial levels. And anyone who knows anything about campaigning and the science of climate change knows that the figure that scientists talk about restricting global warming to is 2 degrees above industrial pre-industrial levels, and that means that we're already halfway there in terms of the warming. And it should be said that we're halfway there after decades where scientists, campaigners, and writers have been telling politicians that this is happening, that it is real, and it is going to have an enormous threat. And as we look towards the Paris conference that's going to take place at the end of this year, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, it is worth bearing in mind that we now have had 20 national, international United Nations conferences that have talked about a serious global action on climate change, yet we are halfway to the threatened level. What will that mean? It's always worth, even though I suspect most people in this room know, or think they know, or feel confident about the science of climate change and the social and economic and political impacts of climate change, it is always worth reminding ourselves what that will mean. Here's the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization quoted in the introduction to the report, Michael Gerard. This means hotter global temperatures, more extreme weather events like heat waves and floods, melting ice, rising sea levels, and increased acidity of the oceans. This is happening now, and we are already into uncharted territory. We know what that will mean. It will mean extinctions on an enormous scale of species. It will mean poverty and hunger. It will mean famine. It will mean enormous numbers of people forced to flee their homes as refugees and as economic migrants. It will mean tens of millions of people suffer in horrible ways. And as I'll come on to in a minute, it will primarily hit the poorest and the most vulnerable in society. So that's where we are. That's the challenge we face, really, is dealing with a system and a scenario where we're already halfway to the danger zone, as they say. The second report I want to talk about today is one that not many people would have even heard of. It's a report by the World Bank called Managing the Impacts of Climate Change on Poverty. Emphasis on the word managing. Climate change, they report, could force, this is the headline quote, could force 100 million people into extreme poverty by 2030. The worst case scenario, the report is quite a detailed statistical economic report, which lists a whole variety of scenarios based on different investment plans, different economic prospects, etc., etc., etc. The worst case scenario is one where 122 million extra people, on top of already of the 900 million already exist in poverty in the world, are forced into what the World Bank calls extreme poverty. And the report emphasises that what climate change will do is not just make people poorer. It will not just impact upon people's lives. It will undermine all the efforts that are being made to reduce poverty already. And that's because, I'm sure many of you can think of examples. It's because floods will destroy people's homes and people's land. It's because droughts will cause food shortages, which will drive up prices of basic foodstuffs, which will hit the first and foremost those at the bottom of society, those in the lowest incomes, the poorest countries, and indeed the poorest people of the developed world as well. And that's a fairly devastating worry. 122 extra million people in extreme poverty within 30 or so years. And the World Bank calls for what they actually call for, and I'm sure they don't really mean it in the sense that many of us would mean it, deep structural changes in the world economy. What they really mean by that, of course, is I think more free market mechanisms, more carbon markets, more exchange mechanisms, and so on. The first step has to be comprehensive packages of emission reduction policies, carbon pricing, and innovation support. And once again, here we see the World Bank's favourite themes, if you like, when it comes to environmental and climate change questions. That the way to deal with these things is to pump more money into technological support, technological and innovation, and also to rely on the free market through carbon pricing and so on. They acknowledge in the summary report, actually, that it's not worked very well. Numerous market failings, including incorrect pricing, split incentives, poor enforcement of existing regulations, and so on. And that's because already all the carbon markets and the exchange mechanisms that have been put in place by various economists and so on have utterly failed to reduce emissions in any way at all. In fact, they've been driven often by corruption, often by misjudgments of the prices of emissions, and so on. So we come to Paris. Paris at the end of the year. Some of us are lucky enough to be going to Paris to join the protests and the demonstrations that will take place. Paris, we have argued in the environment movement, is an important staging point, though what we've tried to argue is that it's not the last ditch stand. The danger with that, I think, is that if you say this is the last point, when, as inevitably will happen, the decisions that come out of the Paris conference are short of what activists argue for and what scientists know are needed, there's a danger that you can push the movement into demoralisation and unconfidence. What we try to argue is that Paris is an opportunity for the movement to develop and to grow and to start putting real pressure on politicians. People will talk about it in a bit, but there's two things that we would really encourage people to do: to demonstrate locally on the 28th of November, and Chesterfield, I see, has a rally, and I hope that's as large as possible. But more importantly, to come to London on the 29th of November to build the biggest possible demonstration to put as much pressure as possible on the British politicians to act on climate change, and to build our movement and give confidence to our side that we can do something, because that's the only way we can influence what's going to happen in Paris. There is another way. I was reading on the internet this afternoon that at the actual COP21 conference of parties 21 conference in Paris, there is actually another way you can lobby governments and politicians. And that's the Solutions COP21 conference. Now, Solutions 21 is a private organisation. It's a private conference. So they've been given space inside the United Nations building for the discussion. It's sponsored by a number of interesting organisations with impeccable records on the environment. Coca-Cola, Renault-Nissan, an organisation called GDF Suez, which is a fascinating organisation, 30% owned by the French government, owns 30 coal plants in France, obviously got an interest in lobbying politicians over environmental impacts and fossil fuel emissions. An organisation called Suez Environment, whose main job is lobbying for the shale gas industry. Now, each of those organisations, and many, many others, will be taking space in the conference hall to talk to politicians, to delegates, to concerned parties, to policymakers and so on, about what they would like to see coming out of the conference. They do it with a lot of money. If you've got €30,000, you get the logo on the brochure. If you've got €75,000, you can get 30 metres of space, so 30 square metres of space, and privileged access to the press room. For €150,000, you get 200 square metres and a TV spot in the main conference hall. And if you read brochures for this, what is on offer really is the same as what the World Bank is talking about: carbon markets, carbon capture schemes, fracking biofuels, GM crops and so on, all dressed up in an environmental gloss that talks about emissions reductions and dealing with climate change. And really, I think that's their way of influencing. Our way of influencing it has to be to build this movement that can say, actually, we want something different. But that does beg the question, what is that something different that we want? And I think that there are many different ideas in the movement. I've been part of the campaign against climate change for nigh on a decade now, and I've often heard all sorts of different arguments about what the movement should campaign for and what the movement should should argue for. We put together this Million Climate Jobs pamphlet precisely because we thought that there were a way of arguing against the sort of pro-austerity policies of various previous governments, which could deal with climate change and reduce emissions at the same time as creating jobs for people. But I think that what's also happening inside the environmental movement at the moment is a real change of emphasis, if you like. There's a growth of confidence amongst activists on the ground to talk about really big political questions. I think it's best summed up by Naomi Klein's best-selling book, This Changes Everything, with its wonderful subtitle, Capitalism versus the Climate. The ideas that has brought together have, I think, created discussion on a way that's been unprecedented inside the environmental movement, as people discuss what it is about society that means that you can have 20 international conferences over the last couple of decades, yet politicians have failed to deal anything about climate change. And there's a number of, obviously, rhetorical points you can make. I was talking to James earlier on about the steelworkers. I know there were demonstrations in Scunthorpe. What sort of irrational and mad and lunatic economic system would throw thousands of steelworkers on the dole at the same time as we need to build large numbers of wind turbines up and down the country, at the same time as we need to rebuild the rolling stock for our railways, at the same time as we need to build decent houses with proper insulation and so on. And I would argue, and I would say that not only do we need to save those jobs and protect those jobs and renationalise actually those plans, but actually we need more workers like that whose jobs are not to make profits for large corporations, but to actually help reduce emissions for our future. I think there's also all sorts of other arguments as well. You see, Naomi Klein in her book says that climate change is an opportunity, if you like, to build a more socially just world. I mean, I'd argue that even without climate change, we could still and should still argue for a socially just world. But she does have a point. She does highlight the way that dealing with climate change is not about making ordinary people's lives worse. It's not about self-sacrifice. Dealing with climate change on a big scale is about having a different vision of how you organise society. I often use the example of, you know, I think where I live in Salford, there's around 20% or so youth unemployment. Why not train those young men and women to insulate homes and then send them out with government money to insulate the homes of the pensioners who are going to freeze to death this winter because they can't afford to heat their homes because their homes are so leaky and gas prices are so high. And with all that sort of joint up thinking, you could give people jobs, you could save pensioners' lives, you could reduce bills, and at the same time you could reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide and so on to help deal with climate change. Because ultimately we're now at a stage where that's the sort of grand scale thinking that we need if we want to deal with climate change. That's the big picture stuff that we need. I'm all in favour of everyone recycling. I'm all in favour of everyone walking to work instead of getting a car to work. But really, when we live in the world that we live in, we're going to need a much larger, much bigger scale response than that. And that means a state response, and that's why we have to get to London and be part of building that movement that can start to force our politicians to act. The thing, though, I want to say, though, is that demonstration at the end of November can't simply be the usual suspects. It can't just be environmentalists who've campaigned over these questions for years. It can't simply be activists who know what the impact of the environment is going to be on the future. It has to be one that brings together the trade union movement, the young people from colleges and universities, together with the wider environmental questions. And that's the other reason that we did the Climate Jobs Report, about making people in the trade union movement feel confident to discuss and argue over questions of the environment as part of ammunition to talk about why they need to defend their jobs and their services. So I suppose I'll finish up really by once again encouraging everyone to come on the demonstration in Chesterfield on the 28th of November. I know there's ones in Leeds and Sheffield as well for people who are not from the local area, but also to think very seriously about coming down to London as part of the largest possible network, as well as the largest possible delegation of activists, of campaigners, of ordinary people who want to see a better future. Ultimately, if we don't do it, they will put the money into those failed systems. They will put the money into the carbon markets, the free market mechanisms that have been have shown to fail to do anything around the environment and only to make a tiny number of people very, very well off. And this is our opportunity. We have to seize it, and then we have to think of Paris not as the end but as the beginning of a movement that's not just going to save the planet in terms of dealing with climate change, but it's also going to come out of it with a better world for ordinary men and women, the people who will suffer the most if we don't do that.